Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and while some of the media is buzzing this morning about Paul Manafort possibly about to serve time at Rikers Island, community boards around the city are more concerned with what to do when Rikers closes. At least two now, one in the Bronx and one in Manhattan, have voted against the borough jails that are supposed to replace Rikers in their communities. Maybe we'll ask those Queens DA candidates about that in our debate next Wednesday. And that's just one development that City Council Speaker Corey Johnson has on his plate right now. Another is the new tension between the current management of NYCHA and the new federal monitor appointed to oversee the public housing complexes. The monitor says the NYCHA chair lied in council testimony about progress toward getting the lead out of NYCHA apartments. There are also the city budget negotiations ahead of the July 1st fiscal year. Library funding remains one flashpoint. And the end of the state legislative year in Albany this month, with so many items on the table that affect the city, from the rent laws. There was a big civil disobedience rent laws protest at the Capitol yesterday in the governor's office, to driver's licenses for undocumented immigrants, to so much more. Speaker Johnson is also reconsidering his position on fur clothing, I understand, and proposing a package that he says will, quote, break the car culture in the city. So back with us now, New York City Council Speaker Corey Johnson, with a lot going on. Welcome back to WNYC.
Good morning, Brian.
And listeners, our lines are open to ask the speaker anything pertinent to being speaker. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. Break the car culture. That's a quote from you in the Daily News. Did you say that?
Yes, I did. I think it's important for us to refocus our time and our resources and our energy in making the city safer for pedestrians and for cyclists and for mass transit users. And to me, that means doing everything we can in making our city a city where people can have reliable mass transit, when people can walk across the street and not be afraid of losing their life because of a car or a truck, and making sure that we have more bus lanes and bike lanes for people to use. We have too many people that are killed every year by cars and by trucks, and it's important for us to refocus those efforts. So I introduced a bill that's going to require the Department of Transportation to put together a master plan on how to pedestrianize certain areas in New York City, how to call for more bus lanes, how to have transit signal priority for those bus lanes, how to have more bike lanes, to do these things to finally break the car culture in New York City. And it's good for safety, but it's also good for the environment. It's time to move away from cars and move towards better things. For me, it goes pedestrians, bikes, cars. That is the order of priority.
Congestion pricing, which is coming, used to be once upon a time about reducing congestion, which would make it, you know, more comfortable to drive a car in New York City if you came in. Then it became about fighting ground level pollution, so not as many people had asthma flare-ups and other lung problems. Then it became about fighting climate level pollution. Now it's about revenue for the MTA. What happened to the congestion and the congestion pricing? Are we now just trying to make things as difficult as possible for all drivers?
No, I still think it's all those things. I think it's about decreasing congestion, disincentivizing people from not driving into Manhattan unless they really must, and working on doing something more environmentally friendly, creating a sustainable revenue stream for the MTA that could be dedicated to subways and buses. I still think it is all those things. I am concerned about the fact that the way congestion pricing was enacted through the state budget, it put together a now unnamed six-person committee called the Transit Mobility Review Board, which is going to be housed inside the MTA, which is going to be housed inside of the Triborough Bridge and Tunnel Authority. And that six-person board will meet in November of 2020 and over a 45-day period decide what it's going to look like, what the exemptions are going to be, what the price is going to be, if there are going to be income restrictions for low-income people. So I'm more concerned about those very important specifics, carve-outs that are related to congestion pricing, and we still don't have the answers to that. I'm a big proponent and supporter of congestion pricing. I think it's the right thing to do, but I'm concerned we don't know the details yet.
And speaking of the MTA, I see that your office and the mayor's office have put out a joint press release today announcing that 50,000 New Yorkers are now enrolled in the Fair Fares program, the half-price Metro cards for people based on income. Our reporting indicates that the rollout has been slow and that you have sort of had to drag the mayor to pick up the pace. As of January, I think only about 100 people had signed up. It was expanded to include SNAP beneficiaries. How do you see the rollout?
I don't want to get too technical with you, but I am very, very, very proud of getting Fair Fares in the budget last year in my first 6 months as Speaker of the City Council. We got $106 million in the budget. For listeners that don't know, Fair Fares is a program for low-income New Yorkers that are living below the poverty line to qualify for half-price Metro cards. How many times have any of us seen someone standing at a turnstile begging for a swipe for themselves or for their child, trying to get on the subways? And there are hundreds of thousands of New Yorkers who qualify for this program who are living in poverty. So we fought really hard. It was the council's priority and a signature issue for us to get $106 million in the budget to help New Yorkers who are struggling to get by so they can ride the subway when it's working. And the rollout wasn't perfect. And, you know, I wasn't totally happy with it. I've talked about that. But I'm still happy that today we're over 50,000 people, and that number is going to build even further. It's going to expand to CUNY students who are living in poverty, who this fall will qualify for it. It's going to go to veterans who are living in poverty. It's going to go to anyone living in poverty. We started off with people who are already registered with the city who get food stamps or get cash assistance, and those are the folks that we initially captured to be able to sign up. But we're moving on to qualify more people for it, and I'm really proud. It's going to make a big difference. If you're someone who's making less than $20,000 a year and you're all of a sudden going to get a half-price monthly Metro card, that makes a big difference in your life for you or for your family. So it's something I'm enormously proud of. The rollout could have been done better, but I want to build on the future and continue to help New Yorkers qualify for the program.
One more transit question before we move on to callers and other topics. The governor was here yesterday and he refused to explicitly express confidence in Transit Authority President Andy Byford.
I have confidence in Andy Byford. I think Andy Byford is an incredible leader. I am so grateful that Andy Byford is the president of New York City Transit. He is out and about. He takes the subways and buses every single day. He put forward a transformative plan, the Fast Forward Plan. He fought for more than a year to try to get it fully funded in the next MTA capital plan. He is forward thinking. We've seen what he's done in Toronto and in London and in Sydney. We are lucky to have Andy Byford. He better not be going anywhere. I think it would be a huge blow to the MTA, a huge blow to the city. He has my total and utmost confidence. I am the executive vice president of the Andy Byford fan club.
From the reporting that I've seen, the governor is frustrated that Byford wants to revamp the signal system in the subways in a too conservative way, and the governor wants to do something that's not as tested technologically, but that might be more forward-looking. Do you understand anything about that particular conflict?
I think the difference here is the system that's being put in place and is hopefully finishing sooner, it may have just finished on the 7 train, is communication-based train control system, which makes it so the trains can run closer together without delays. It's what we have on the L train right now, we've had for a few years. That's what they're trying to expand to the 7 train and then to the rest of the system. I believe the governor is interested in looking at ultra-band technology that can put into the tunnel system, and it's a different type of technology. I am not an expert on this. I don't know what's better. I do know that the first one we currently have on the L train, and that seems to work well. I'm open to whatever works best. I don't have the level of expertise to tell you what that is.
Jim, in the South Bronx, you're on WNYC with New York City Council Speaker Corey Johnson. Hi, Jim.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. I'd like to say to you, Mr. Speaker, that I am outraged but not surprised that you and your colleagues want to dump another prison here in the South Bronx. We are already overrun with drug rehab facilities, with homeless facilities and residences, and all the rest of undesirable things. And I think it's the height of effrontery that you should do this and then pass yourself off as a progressive, dumping this on this sort of low-income neighborhood of color. And that's what I have to say to you, sir. If you have any response, I'll take it off air. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I appreciate the call. We, of course, don't see it that way. And I understand that these issues can bring up very strong emotions for people feeling that they don't want these type of facilities in their community. I do think there is an issue that the South Bronx and other predominant communities of color have seen a significant level of homeless shelters and methadone clinics and other facilities cited in their district that have not been done in a fair share type of way. But I think the Rikers issue is a different issue. We've seen other places around the world. We've seen other municipalities and states across the country where they have cited borough, they have cited local jail facilities in communities. It has had no impact on crime. It has had no impact on property values. It has had no impact on hurting the quality of life in these communities. These four sites in the South Bronx, in Lower Manhattan, in downtown Brooklyn, and in Queens, in Kew Gardens, these sites are sites, some of whom not in the Bronx, but some of the sites are places where there were previously jails. And in the Bronx, the community is going to get a significant level of investment for the rest of the community to do all sorts of things. I'm really proud of the council members, Ayala, Levin, Chin, and Kozlowitz for, I think, their courage on leading on this. And again, I don't think we're dumping anything on anyone because having a jail facility doesn't mean something bad is going to happen. I'll end with this, Brian, because I know we have a lot to talk about. In my district in Chelsea, for many, many years, there was a jail at 20th Street and the West Side Highway. It was a small jail. It was the Bayview Women's Correctional Facility. And when Sandy hit in 2012, it was flooded and it was never able to be reopened. When the Sandy was over, the community said, reopen the jail where it is. It has been a good neighbor. It has been a place that there has been no issues for decades with it being there. It's been a place where people come visit their families. There is nothing wrong with it. I think we need to demystify this issue. Rikers Island is a symbol of failure. It's a symbol of mass incarceration. We need to move beyond that and build better, more humane, borough-based facilities. In a time of decarceration, that's what we need to do.
You ready to have Paul Manafort there, by the way?
You know, as horrible a person as I think Paul Manafort is, and I think he is someone that needs to pay for his crimes, I still don't support solitary confinement for him because I think it is cruel and unusual punishment. I think it's torture. He was already convicted of a crime. Cy Vance is now bringing up on other charges. And I think that Paul Manafort needs to be brought to justice, but I don't support solitary confinement.
The rent laws, June 15th deadline in Albany, big changes possible with Democratic control of the Senate in place this year. Big demonstrations in Albany yesterday, big mobilization around this. Is there anything you most want or anything you most fear?
Well, 4 years ago at this exact time in 2015, I was arrested in the Capitol during a similar protest with Jumaane Williams, who was a council member then. I know he was arrested yesterday as public advocate, and we were arrested with some other council members and activists and state legislators. I want the nine bills. I want all nine bills. That's what I think is important, repealing vacancy decontrol, getting rid of the preferential rent differences, looking at MCIs and individual apartment improvements, getting good cause eviction. There are other bills in there. I support that. And I hope that's what's going to happen. We have over 2 million people who are in rent-regulated apartments in New York City who are relying on this. We have a homelessness crisis. States like New Jersey and Oregon have passed good cause eviction bills. We have an eviction crisis. We have a housing crisis. We have a homelessness crisis. It is time for us to do this. So many New Yorkers are relying upon us.
The good cause eviction bill, which I gather now does have support in the Senate, at least has the support of the majority leader, Andrea Stewart-Cousins. I don't know if it has the votes, and I don't know if it has the assembly. It would be the biggest change, probably, of anything in the whole package of nine, because it would bring all the non-rent-stabilized rentals in the city, or most of them, under a kind of control that I believe would limit rent increases to 1.5 times the rate of inflation. Is that your understanding of the bill? And what do you say to landlords who say, holy cow, this is not what I bargained for when I bought my building?
Well, that is the construct of the bill, but we've seen it happen in other places without there being big issues. And again, the rent increase would need to be unconscionable and defined as unconscionable. I think the vast majority of tenants are not going to want to fight. They're going to want to just re-sign their lease at a reasonable amount and stay in their place. Landlords are going to want continuity. Tenants are going to want continuity. But it's important to provide more protections for people who are currently scared that they may lose their lease. And we've seen gigantic rent increases all over the city and neighborhoods, especially when communities gentrify. We've seen displacement happen. We've seen evictions happen that are unconscionable and unreasonable. It's time for us to pass this. It's the right thing to do for tenants across New York City. It's the most important issue that is facing New Yorkers as the legislative session in Albany winds down.
Did I overstate the provisions? Because I don't want to overstate it if it's less draconian from a landlord standpoint than merely 1.5 times that year's inflation rate for a cap on rent increases.
I'm not sure I understand what you're saying.
Does that good cause eviction law limit rent increases to 1.5 times that year's rate of inflation?
I'm not sure if it limits it, but it would say that if the proposed rent decrease was more than 1.5% of inflation, then there would be a process by which a tenant could contest that increase, and there would be an outside mediator, arbitrator, someone that would have to come in and look at it and determine whether or not that is fair. Again, we don't want an unreasonable rate increase, rent increase, which would cause people to lose their homes.
And if I said 1.5% the rate of inflation, it's 1.5 times the rate of inflation,
yes.
Just to be clear on our multiplier there. Kim in Manhattan, you're on WNYC with New York City Council Speaker Corey Johnson. Hi, Kim.
Yes, good morning, gentlemen. How are you?
Okay. Good morning.
Good morning. I'm calling with regard to the proposed fur ban. Last week, Speaker Johnson, I believe that you insulted most of the fur industry by announcing that we could go work in cloth. And so if our legal, unharmful fur fashions were to be banned in New York City, where do you see our talented, hardworking labor force transferring our skill set to, where we could still earn the wages and do the talent that we do? Because I do not see those positions listed in Indeed.com or on the NYC job bank. So what are we going to go do?
Well, Brian, you mentioned it at the beginning of the show in the intro where you said that I was rethinking my position on this. I didn't say that I was rethinking it. I haven't backed away from my support of the bill. I believe that fur is unnecessary and cruel to animals. I believe what we've seen is the way they are killed is barbaric. I know the fur industry has been lobbying really hard to kill the ban. It's a major multi-billion dollar industry. That's not what has impacted me. I was actually moved by some of the testimony of the furriers, and I wasn't rethinking my position, but I said, as Kim just mentioned, that we could have a longer phase-in period, which is what Los Angeles did when they passed a similar bill. San Francisco passed a similar bill. Countries across Europe have been re-regulating or banning certain parts of fur farming, and so that is why we have hearings, to learn more, to listen to people who have been impacted. I think the process works. What Kim just mentioned is I believe you could do some job retraining programs. Many of the skills that are used to build to work on garments, repurposing of documents, manufacturing of garments, can be used for other types of garments. We've seen we've seen major designers, whether it's Stella McCartney or Diane von Furstenberg or Donna Karan. Last week, Prada announced they're no longer using fur. Move to more ethical products. There are more ethical products we could use. You could give time for a phase in, and the city could provide some job retraining resources to help people move away towards more ethical products. I think the disagreement, and you know, that I have here is I do believe that it is cruel and inhumane for a luxury product to kill an animal, to farm an animal, and just for their fur to put in the lining of a coat. I think the difference here, people want to bring up leather. The difference on leather is that leather is a co-product of meat that is already being slaughtered for the consumption. So leather, you're already going to get if you are slaughtering a cow. If you're raising a mink or a chinchilla, you're not raising them for their meat. You're literally trapping them or farming them in a cage just to kill them. I think we need to evolve as a society. That's what I support doing. And I want to find a way to do this that helps protect animals while at the exact same time gives time to phase this in for the industry itself.
Kim, let me ask you, are you defending the ethical basis of fur clothing or just defending your job?
So I'm defending the product. The product is specifically bred for what has been done since the beginning of time in being able to utilize fur fashions. I'm defending our jobs and our companies and our businesses, most of which are owned and operated by immigrant people who came to this country to earn a living and raise their families and contribute to society. I would love Speaker Johnson to come and visit some of our companies. I do not believe that has happened yet. I don't understand how you can make decisions without wholeheartedly researching what we do here, because we're not doing anything illegal.
Will you take him to a farm, not just to the fashion district?
As far as I know, and I've been working in this industry for 28 years, we do not have any fur farms in New York City. So it's not something you're going to find here.
And Kim, I'm going to leave it there.
Well, that's the issue, Brian, is the fur farms. It's not about going and watching the actual garments being made. It's where does that product come from? Where are the farms? A lot of the fur that's imported comes from China and Russia, where they are incredibly inhumane to these animals. A lot of the fur comes from trapped fur, where animals get their legs caught in a trap, and they have to gnaw their leg off for days until they're found by the trapper, or a cat or a dog or another animal that was not meant to be trapped gets caught in that trap. Just because we've done it a long time does not mean it's the reason to continue to do it. A society is said to be judged in how we treat animals, and I don't think we would support cats and dogs, their fur being used for these type of products, because we love them, and animals are sentient beings. Now, at the same time, I want to be humane towards animals and thoughtful and humane towards people who have worked in this industry a long time, which is why I said there is a way to do a long phase-in period, a way to do a job retraining program. You've seen other companies, major companies, the ones I've named, move towards more ethical products, and there's a way to do that here, which gives time to bridge from now until when it goes into effect.
New York City
Council. But I want to be clear, I am not rethinking my support. I was trying to be more sensitive on the bill.
And maybe the phase-in.
Exactly.
New York City Council Speaker Cory Johnson, our guest for another few minutes. City budget. Deadline, June 30th. Library cuts are one flashpoint with the libraries these days, as you know, being so much more than books, especially for lower-income New Yorkers, internet access, after-school safe haven, a place where people will fill out census forms next year with the Trump administration, hoping for a New York undercount. I understand that's one of their roles. So what's the story with library cuts? They're saying they may have to reduce their hours.
We do not support any reduction in funding for libraries. We have three incredible systems, the New York Public Library, which covers Staten Island, Manhattan, and the Bronx, the Queens Public Library, and the Brooklyn Public Library. Last Friday, I went to a branch in Brooklyn to read a poem for Walt Whitman's 200th birthday, which it would have been, to show my support of the libraries. I did toddler time last week on the steps of City Hall, reading to toddlers. Libraries are really important places. They're one of the most egalitarian things, not just about New York City, but in our entire society. They're places for learning. They're places for personal evolution. They're open to everyone. Libraries are gateways to new citizens, towards greater literacy, towards community community building. We want to build and get more funding for libraries. We don't support the proposed cuts. We want to get capital money to invest in our existing library buildings and programmatic funds for new libraries that need to open. So the council is going to fight for more library funding.
I thought there was an agreement, and since you're mentioning your appearance at the libraries, listeners on Staten Island, in case you're interested, I'll be doing an appearance at the Stapleton branch next Tuesday evening. But I thought there was some agreement between you and the mayor that the library funding was not going to, at least not going to keep pace with their expenses on the sort of year-by-year increase that had been taking place. So if it's flat, that's in effect a cut because inflation continues. Or so what's your real position
here? It's a little complicated. The mayor released a PEG program, a program to eliminate the GAP program, which is a savings and cut program as part of the executive budget. In that, there was a proposal to cut $3 million from the library system. And the council last year won an $8 million one-shot, one-time agreement on library funding. That funding wasn't included either. So that would have been an $11 million cut existing from the library system. The libraries this year came forward and said they needed additional $30 million, not counting that $11 million, $30 million to be able to hire the staff and do the work in the libraries, the newly opened libraries, and other libraries that have six-day service. So we're asking for a restoration of that $11 million cut, and we're fighting for that $30 million new need that the library systems put forward. That's what's happening right now.
What else are the flashpoints in the budget right now? You and the mayor are doing this dance, and things other than the libraries, things have not gotten a lot of publicity. I know we got a press release from a group that's very worried about health funding. What's called, I think, Article 6.
Article 6 cuts. Yeah, there were some cuts from the state of New York as part of the state budget.
For a lot of immigrants and other low-income New Yorkers.
Yes, so it cuts some programs where we get a match from the state and getting more state funding. These programs could be HIV and AIDS or maternal health. So there was a $3 million cut there that we're going to fight on. We want to get more money for parks across New York City. We want more money for sanitation pickup. How many New Yorkers see overflowing trash cans in their neighborhood? We need more pickup from the sanitation department. And one of the biggest issues out there, Brian, two of them, we want to fight for more reserves. It's not a sexy issue, but you want budget reserve. So when that downturn comes, that there's a cushion to land on. We're fighting for $250 million in budget reserves. Last year, the council fought for $225 million in budget reserves. And one of the final big issues is we need pay parity for childhood workers and community-based organizations, non-DOE employees. Right now, they're paid...
The pre-K teachers.
The pre-K teachers are paid significantly less than DOE teachers. They deserve to have pay parity. They're predominantly African-American women who are being paid substantially less. They deserve pay parity. Legal defense providers deserve pay parity. There are other folks that deserve pay parity. These are some of the issues that we're looking at. A budget is a document of our values and priorities. It's $92.5 billion. The city council outlaid a document in our budget response saying what our priorities are, and we're going to fight for those over the month of June.
But if you're laying out all these increases, and you want to put even more away for savings for a rainy day in the reserve fund, and projections of future tax revenues are lower than they've been in recent years, where's all the money for this going to come from?
We identified in the preliminary budget response $600 million in savings. The council identified, not
what's
the mayor's side.
What's being cut?
Well, there are a lot of different programs that we think aren't potentially working anymore. We outline those. I mean, there are literally dozens of things we proposed.
What's the most expensive one?
Well, some of them are re-estimates of what we actually spend. So we underspend in certain areas. So it's right-sizing that so you can spend it correctly. The Department of Education proposed some unnecessary programs that they didn't think worked anymore. There are a variety. You go agency by agency. We outlined it in a document, and we proposed $600 million. They took our $600 million in cuts, and then they didn't invest in any of our priorities. So we're calling for greater savings, reinvesting in new priorities, and putting money aside for a rainy day if it eventually comes.
This is WNYC FM HD and AM New York, WNJT FM 88.1 Trenton, WNJP 88.5 Sussex, WNJY 89.3 Netcong, and WNJO 90.3 Toms River. We are New York and New Jersey Public Radio. almost done with Speaker Cory Johnson. Let me just touch two things briefly in our remaining overtime. The accusation by the new federal monitor for NYCHA that the chairman was not truthful in a city council hearing about how fast the lead paint is being removed. Did you get lied to?
I don't know yet. That's the answer. I know Catherine Garcia, the interim chair of NYCHA, called me after she received this letter from Bart Schwartz, who's the current monitor. And she, again, I wasn't there when that testimony happened, and our staff is looking at it. But I don't know. Catherine Garcia, who before she took this role as interim NYCHA chair, is our sanitation commissioner. She's someone I've had a good relationship with. We want to make sure that NYCHA is transparent. I think the issue here is that Bart Schwartz, the monitor, said that the testimony related to doing outreach to families and apartments with children under the age of 6 years old to do an inventory of where those apartments are and then doing the lead paint remediation and abatement, that NYCHA wasn't forthcoming in the council hearings about that. We want to make sure they're forthcoming. Lead paint is a major issue. Children's brains will be permanently altered if they are poisoned by it. Brian, it didn't get a ton of press, but a few months ago, the New York City Council passed the most forward-reaching, forward-thinking protective laws on lead paint poisoning in the entire country. We passed a package of bills we spent over a year on. They related to NYCHA and to non-NYCHA apartments. We take this issue very seriously, and we want to know what the facts are.
Last thing, June is Pride Month, as always. This may be the biggest ever in New York City with the 50th anniversary of Stonewall. What are you looking forward to?
Brian, I came to New York City for the first time when I visited around my 18th birthday in 2000. The first place I went on the first day I showed up was Christopher Street to see Stonewall with my own eyes. So to be the council member who represents Greenwich Village, to be Speaker of the New York City Council, to be an openly gay man, to be the only openly HIV positive elected official in the state of New York, that is possible not because of me, but because of all the people that came before me, the heroes, the trailblazers, the amazing activists who made it possible for someone like me. 50 years after Stonewall, we've made enormous progress, but there's still so much more to do. This year it's World Pride, Brian, so we're going to get, I think, over 4 million people on the parade route. It's going to be on June 30th, the last Sunday in June. We've seen rollbacks at the federal level. New York City is very, very lucky because we have the biggest LGBT community in the world. And I'll just end with this, and then we have to go. New York City is the greatest city in the world. We gave the world J-Lo and Barbara Streisand. We are the home of the Lemon Ice King of Corona. Not far from here, the Statue of Liberty sits in our harbor with a torch as a beacon to immigrants and refugees and asylum seekers. And 50 years ago, Stonewall, the uprising, lit a match for worldwide equality. I am so proud to be alive and to be in this position during Pride Month and the 50th anniversary of Stonewall.
And I will just mention that this show will be doing a six-part series starting on June 21st on history. It's a history series, decade by decade since Stonewall, that starts on June 21st. And we thank New York City Council Speaker Cory Johnson for coming on and answering my questions and listeners' questions. Thank you so much.
Happy Pride, Brian.